I wanted to make a prediction today, and now I have never watched Game of Thrones. Do we have any Game of Thrones? You don't have to confess in front of everyone, but I'm just kidding. I've never watched one episode of Game of Thrones, but I wanted to make a prediction today because the eighth and final season began this past week, I understand. That's 8 seasons, 80 episodes, and I have a prediction for how it's going to end. Well, not how it's going to end, but about the ending. And my prediction is this, that some people are going to love the ending, and other people are going to hate the ending. Because ending an epic story is a difficult thing. And, you know, there have been, what did I say, about 80, there will have been about 80 episodes of Game of Thrones by the time it's done. I mean, it's hard to end a movie well. It's hard to end, like, think of Lord of the Rings trilogy, that's like 9-10 hours of movie. This is 80 hours. This is like an 80-hour story that they are trying to end this season. And that's a difficult thing. And it's difficult because if you end it happily, and you tie up all the loose ends, you run the risk of it really just kind of feeling trite, just too easy, and not very realistic. On the other hand, if you end it in a sorrowful way, it might feel a little more realistic. Life is hard, right? We know that everything doesn't end in a happy ending, but at the same time, when people have invested 80 hours of their life, you don't want to send them home feeling hopeless, right? Like, that's just, no one wants that. It's hard to end an epic story. So how do we end the story of Jesus? We have 4 stories of Jesus in our Bibles, the 4 Gospels, and you would think today on Easter Sunday, really, I mean, come on, resurrection writes itself. There's never been an easier ending to a story. Like, you can't mess this up, right? Let's go to Mark. Let's go to the Gospel of Mark, chapter 16, verses 1 through 8. When the Sabbath was over, Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of James and Salome, bought spices so that they might go and anoint him. And very early on the first day of the week, when the sun had risen, they went to the tomb. They'd been saying to one another, "Who will roll away the stone for us from the entrance to the tomb?" But when they looked up, they saw that the stone, which was very large, had already been rolled back. As they entered the tomb, they saw a young man dressed in a white robe sitting on the right side, and they were alarmed. But he said to them, "Do not be alarmed. You are looking for Jesus of Nazareth, who was crucified. He's been raised. He's not here. Look, there is the place where they laid him. But go, tell his disciples and Peter that he is going ahead of you to Galilee. There you will see him, just as he told you." So they went out and fled from the tomb, for terror and amazement had seized them, and they said nothing to anyone, for they were afraid. The Gospel of the Lord. Praise be to you, O Christ. That's it. That is where the Gospel of Mark ends. Now, if you have your Bibles open, you might see that there's more to it written there. One of them is called the shorter ending of Mark. One of them is called the longer ending of Mark. But it's pretty clear that these were not written by Mark. That someone later on came and said, this is not how a gospel should end. And so they said, okay, well, this is how we end this story. And they added it on. But that's not where Mark's gospel ends. Mark's gospel ended right where I stopped reading. And they said nothing to anyone, for they were afraid. Now, it's unclear whether we've actually lost the original ending of Mark's gospel. That's possible. Ancient documents are hard to preserve, and so it's very possible that part of it was just lost, and we don't have it. But it's also possible that Mark actually meant to end like that. What we have actually ends on the word gar. It's a Greek word. Can you all say it? You can sound like a Easter pirate today. Gar. You say that, gar. So you learned your Greek for today. And gar is the word for or because. I mean, what kind of story ends with the word for? It's a strange ending. Now, we've spent the season of Lent exploring trauma, exploring how trauma impacts our lives, and we've talked about how trauma is tricky, that we may not even consciously remember an event, or even if we do remember, we may have a story, but most of trauma, whether it's a big T trauma, major traumatic experience, or small T traumas, smaller ones that happen to us, most of trauma lives beneath our consciousness and awareness. It kind of has a life of its own in our bodies and in our brains. We said the obvious symptoms of trauma are like the tip of an iceberg. But really, the impact of trauma is that our entire lives get built around the remnants of that trauma and the ways that we have learned to cope with it. The ways we try in the wake of something that's happened that's unpredictable and uncontrollable, where we feel helpless and overwhelmed, the rest of our life gets shaped around trying to find stability and security and survive and find some sense of control in this unstable and unpredictable world. It's kind of like a plant or a tree that grows around some sort of object. And if that object is removed, the tree remains shaped like that. So it is with trauma, that we, our lives grow around our fear. And even when the threat is removed, our lives and our behaviors and the ways we approach the world continue to be shaped by that fear. St. Augustine is famous for giving us this phrase, incurvatus in se. And what that means is, Augustine says that we are, as human beings, as sinful human beings, we are curved or bent inward on ourselves. And it's a really fascinating image, but for Augustine, it's often thought that he was talking about that we're selfish, that when we're bent inward on ourselves, we're unable to look and be aware of other people. We're unable to love and serve other people because we're so focused on ourselves. And it's an image of selfishness. But as I reflected on trauma and our bodies and how it all works together, I realized that this image of being incurvatus in se, of bent inward upon ourselves, is not just a posture of selfishness. It's actually a posture of self-protection. You see, we bend inward on ourselves because that makes us, that's a less vulnerable position than having ourselves open and welcoming to others in the world. And so that selfishness, that sin is not merely, it's not just selfishness, it's fear. It's that we're afraid of being vulnerable and exposed to the world. And our lives do indeed get shaped in curvatus in se, in this mode of self-protection. They become shaped around our fear. And so even as we go about our daily lives, as we've said, we often want to think that we walk around fully conscious and making rational and wise decisions. But the reality is, because we've been so shaped by our fear, what seems to be common sense, what seems to be rational and wise and conscious, is actually what's been shaped, our beliefs, our responses, our feelings, and how they've been shaped by our fears and our traumas.
So sin is not just some random bad decisions we happen to make. It's the wiring of our brains. It's the state of our souls. And so after all of this conversation that we've had during Lent, it might seem like we could just pick the Gospels with the neater and tidier endings, right? But the reality is, Easter is anything but neat and tidy. Easter does anything but give us the stability and predictability that we long for in this world. Because if there was anything that was stable and predictable about life in this world, it was death. And as much as we may fear death and want to avoid death, at the very least, it offers to us order. It's familiar. It's stable. We know the rules. It's something certain in an uncertain world. But on Easter, all of a sudden, the world is not playing by the rules. Not even death is certain anymore. And we wonder why the disciples were so afraid, why the women were so afraid, and why they left and didn't say anything at first. It's kind of like if the cross kind of pulled the rug out from under them. These women have just witnessed this traumatic event of the cross, and it's like the rug being pulled out from under them. But then the resurrection comes and yanks out the floorboards themselves. Because when they came to the tomb on Easter morning, they were doing what they learned to do. They were coping in the way they learned to cope. Someone dies, we know what to do. We know how to handle this. We had two funerals this week here at church. Two longtime members. And we know what to do. Right? Like we go to the funeral. We pay our respects. We have things we say. We do all the rituals and all that. And that's what the women were doing. They were doing what they knew how to do. They were coping with death. And all cultures find some way of coping with death ritually. But now all of a sudden, even that is thrown up in the air. There's a painting I came across this week. It's called The Disciples, Peter and John Running to the Sepulchre on the Morning of the Resurrection. And I promise you, it's a better painting than it is a title. Really, he could have come up with a better title than that, I think. But it was painted in 1898 by a Swiss artist named Eugène Bernand. And I was looking at this painting this week and reading an article about it. And if you just kind of look at it for a minute, I'm going to read you what one critic said of this painting. He said, "The picture crackles with kinetic energy. It is a study in desperate anticipation. Surely this is also the posture with which we should approach Easter, leaning in, wringing our hands, clutching our chests, desperate for it to be true." And you can see that in there, can't you? That desperation, that they've heard the news, they're not ready to really let out and be joyful about it. But maybe it's because of all the talk of trauma we've had and what I was thinking already for today, but I saw something else in there. I saw a desperation, like Mike Frost says, for it to be true, but I also saw a terror at how its truth would change everything. The disciples, the women, are desperate for this Easter news to be true and yet terrified at how its truth would change everything. Because even death is now uncertain and stripped of its power, what else is up for grabs? What else can't be relied on? Mark leaves us with fearful women, desperate for this news to be true, but not yet ready to embrace this new world where anything is possible, where anything goes. Because like us, the women at the tomb and Peter and John spent most of their lives being shaped by trauma, growing and shaping themselves around their fears and their coping and trying to survive and avoid death with that certainty sitting in front of them all the time. They'd spent their whole lives being shaped by this reality in this world where death is certain. Fear and death are harsh masters, but most of us have found some sort of equilibrium living in our master's house. And the mere event of Jesus' resurrection doesn't magically change all of that about us. It doesn't magically take us from bent inward to joyful and happy all the time. That's not how it works. We're liberated from our slavery, and yet that liberation can be a terrifying prospect. We have to relearn everything about who we are and how to live under the rule of God, who is far more wild and unpredictable than we'd imagined God to be. It is a life's work, being reshaped by love and hope and joy. The good news, though, is that God does have more for us and more for our lives. That God meets us in our incurvatus in se and enters into us and moves to slowly but surely. And it can be a painful process. It's almost a surgical process. You picture the braces when you have your teeth, you know, when you're young, your teeth are all over the place. And you put those braces in, and man, I had braces from when I was in third grade until I was a junior in high school. I had something in my mouth reshaping my teeth, trying to pull them ever so slowly back to their proper place. That is the Christian life. The good news is that God is at work in us. Anything goes now. The future is wide open. The thing with trauma, the thing with fear, is there are really only three responses. There's only three ways of living. There's fight, there's flight, and there's freeze. And it's really quite dull after a while. But in love, in resurrection, in hope, the future is filled with possibility and potential. Love can take infinite shapes and manifest in infinite ways. It's a far more exciting and adventurous way of living life. Let's get back to Mark. Serene Jones, who's the author of the book Trauma and Grace, shares a meditation on this gospel, and she informs her readers that in the ancient world, we have to remember that not everyone had these books. Not everyone could read, for that matter. Most people couldn't read. And so most texts were not just read, but performed for groups of people. And she says that in ancient rhetoric, there was this practice where a writer would leave space in a text for the performer to gesture the next movement of the story. She writes, when sacred rhetoric meets the embedded realities of traumatic images, perhaps silence accompanied by gesture is the only appropriate response. Perhaps this gospel, the end of this gospel, for the end of this gospel, this whole resurrection story, Mark is the one who realizes that this cannot be captured in words, that the infinite possibility and potential cannot be wrapped up in a chapter, but must be fully embodied as our healing and as our growth must be fully embodied. That is how this story is meant to end. Perhaps it is only in gestures and sacraments and in our lives that Mark's story can be finished. And so I want to offer you this morning, I want to perform an ending to Mark's gospel for you this morning. I want to try to embody this story of the women coming to the tomb and hearing from the angels and having those floorboards pulled out from under them and the fear that that must have been for them. And then where might this story go? And as I do this, I wonder if you might see something of your own soul in your own life that might not have been captured by words, but maybe there's something in the gesture. that can be the ending of your story this morning. Here we go. Maybe Mark's ending to his gospel isn't the best of the other gospels. But perhaps Mark isn't really trying to write an ending. Maybe Mark is just writing a beginning to your story and my story, the women's story, the disciples' story, the beginning, in which we can find and be honest about our fears of what this news might mean for us and step into a new life and a new world. And that can be terrifying. But the good news is, there is one who has gone before us and who goes with us. And his name is love.